I'll call the first case this morning, which is City of Sioux Falls versus Johnson Properties, LLC, appeal number 30947. Drew Dreesen will be arguing on behalf of the defendant, plaintiff appellant, City of Sioux Falls, and Clint Sargent will be arguing on behalf of Johnson Properties, LLC. Aaron Whittleson is also present at counsel table. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. Dreesen, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. You can proceed, Mr. Dreesen.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Drew Dreesen, and I'm here on behalf of the City of Sioux Falls. This case concerns the manner in which attorney fee awards are calculated in condemnation. In particular, South Dakota's fee shifting statute provides that whenever a landowner recovers a total amount at a jury trial that's in at least 20% in excess of the final offer he received prior to that jury trial, he's entitled to a, quote, reasonable attorney fee. No one here disputes that that statute applies. Instead, the question for this court is what makes a fee, quote unquote, reasonable. This court's precedents guide the way in that regard. In particular, this court has observed on several occasions, including in Kelly, perhaps the seminal case in this area, that the only legitimate starting point in the analysis is to calculate the so-called lodestar figure. That is, to multiply a reasonable number of hours expended on the case times a reasonable hourly rate to arrive at a presumptively reasonable figure.
And that happened here, did it not?
It did indeed, Your Honor.
Yeah.
And the calculation that resulted in this case was $61,740.
How did the court err in that calculation? Is your argument that the error occurred because it's not in the court's formal findings of fact and conclusions of law? Because we know the court considered that number.
Certainly. So with respect to, we allege a few errors, but I think the one Your Honor is inquiring about concerns the actual calculation of the fee award itself. We're aware that the court was cognizant of the fee award. We presented it at a hearing, and we objected to the proposed finding of fact and conclusion in several spots on the basis of that it was absent from those findings of fact and conclusions of law. I think the thing to keep in mind with respect to the calculation itself is that the very point of the lodestar, at least one of the chief points as I've heard it articulated, is to help and assist appellate review so you can understand what justified deviations, how much those deviations were.
My understanding, though, is that the parties kind of, I don't know about stipulated, but at least there was no dispute that the hourly rate, the amount of time incurred in the case, that was reasonable. And I think the city did not object to that fee award, at least the 61,000, I think it is, a calculation. So the court kind of started from there and then talked about what was really in dispute. You disagree with that?
So I agree that it was referenced at least at the hearing. I disagree that it's evident anywhere in the findings of fact and conclusions of law. And I think that is dispositive in this instance. For example, we cite two. I understand they're not South Dakota State Court precedent, but we cite two Eighth Circuit cases in which the court vacated the award solely on the basis that the lodestar fails to appear.
So what does victory look like then, from your perspective? You hit this argument out of the park. We say, you're right, it should have been in the findings of fact. Remand, Judge Clapper puts in the findings of fact, the lodestar is $61,000. It's the presumptive starting point, and the contingent fee arrangement alone is not itself a reasonable basis. That all appears. Then the judge goes and analyzes the Kelly factors, maybe in exactly the same way. Have we moved the meter in terms of really where the case is at?
Strictly in a legal sense, has the meter moved? Yes. But I think Your Honor has keyed in on why there are several more pages in our brief after we point out this initial error. And I think that this court is fully equipped in this case in particular to actually resolve what the reasonable amount of attorney fees is without resorting even to a remand.
So one of your arguments relates to this, that there's a heightened or increased fee already built into the hourly rate Can you tell me about that?
Certainly. So opposing counsel presented an affidavit at the attorney fee stage of proceedings below, in which he represented that he charges a $450 $450 hourly rate in condemnation cases in particular, and justified it on the basis that, and we don't disagree, that he has wide experience in that area of the law.
So do we know in the record, is that $450 rate, is that, you know, above maybe what a standard rate is for some other commercial case or some other type of litigation? Is that a 25% increase? Is that a 50%, 75%? I mean, do we know what, there's anything in the record that tells us what a typical rate would be for a non-condemnation case litigation, commercial or some other type of litigation?
No, there's nothing in the record that represents a precise numerical increase from what a standard rate would be. I think what is in the record is the justification for the increased fee award. And I think we can intuit from that fact that he can charge, well, it's not even really intuiting. He states outright that he can charge that figure for these stated reasons, which happen to overlap substantially with figures that are with the so-called Kelly factors that are in, and they're embedded in the lodestar in this particular circumstance.
Counsel, will you define lodestar for the benefit of those in attendance?
Certainly. So the lodestar, as I noted initially at the outset, the lodestar is you come to a reasonable hourly rate, and then you multiply it by a reasonable number of hours expended in the case. As I think a few of you have observed, the city did not object either to the $450 hourly rate in this case, or to the 137.2 hours actually expended in this case. So that's where the two inputs in this case come from, where we arrive at that 61,740 figure. It's 450 times 137.2.
So if you could talk a little bit about what I call, maybe it's not fair, but I kind of call it your lodestar preemption argument, right? The double counting argument. So the argument that you make in the brief is that some of the Kelly factors are already contemplated in the lodestar amount. So I guess then your argument is they can't be counted again.
That's essentially correct, Your Honor. So there are eight factors articulated in Kelly. A handful of those we both agree aren't that issue in this case, just because of the circumstances of this case. Then there's this kind of the separate issue of the contingency fee related factors. And then there are a handful of factors which are at issue in our double counting argument that based on our reading of the findings of fact and conclusion of law are accounted for both at the outset, at the input stage into that lodestar. They're essentially built in either to that $450 hourly figure or into the reasonable amount of time expended. And then the court proceeded to take account of them again, subsequent to calculating the lodestar to justify an increase. Perhaps the easiest one to understand intuitively is one of the Kelly factors is the novelty of the issues or difficulty of the issues involved in the case. That is almost by its nature reflected in the amount of time that's actually expended in the case or in counsel's hourly rate.
Yeah, but those are actually separate Kelly factors. So if that were true, then why would there be additional factors that contemplate those specific things in addition to, so maybe even the Kelly factors are double counting or overlapping, and that could be the case, but if your argument is that contemplates, you know, those discrete considerations, those other considerations already exist in particular Kelly factors.
There is certainly some overlap, I think, between the Kelly among the Kelly factors themselves, and I assume that's just a bootstrapping approach. These factors are originally derived from the model rules of professional conduct for what attorneys can charge the fees, and before that, I believe they first made their entry into the jurisdiction into the jurisprudence in a Fifth Circuit case decided in the 1970s. As far as the overlap. Any overlap that might exist between the Kelly factors and the lodestar itself, I do think the Kelly factors still serve some purpose, and it's essentially to cover for circumstances in which, for example, there might be a dispute about what the lodestar is, what one of the inputs is, and the Kelly factors draw the court's attention to make sure that particular consideration, whatever it is adequately reflected in the lodestar figures or after the fact, whichever.
But aren't you presuming that the lodestar calculation, although it maybe contemplates some of these factors implicitly, aren't you then premising your argument on the idea that that's it? The judge could never consider anything other than you know, the extent to which they're addressed in the lodestar factor. But is that sound as a premise? Why couldn't the judge say, you know, I mean, yeah, here was the time and here was the rate and we got our lodestar calculation. But you know what? I want to emphasize in the exercise of my discretion some of these factors more so than others, because I don't think they're really adequately accounted for in a particular case like this.
I think the key word there is adequate. And so we don't dispute in a case where for one reason or another that the lodestar or what the parties perceive as the lodestar doesn't adequately capture one of the factors that it should be accounted for at, either in the initial input or later in an adjustment. What we're saying here is that on this factual record, they are all accounted for by virtue of the affidavit that was entered into the record.
So it seems like our standard review in this case is abuse of discretion. You know, maybe if each one of us on the court had sat as trial court judges, we might have come up with a different figure of what's reasonable and applying the factors and looking at the hourly rates. Seems like you're asking us to kind of reweigh the factors. Is there an error of law that the court made, and can you identify what that is in terms of us considering that standard review abuse of discretion?
Certainly. I agree that what I would call the umbrella standard, for lack of a better term, is abuse of discretion. That's what we evaluate fee awards on, generally speaking. This court has emphasized, though, repeatedly and correctly, that an error of law in the course of exercising discretion is reviewable de novo. And our position here is that there was indeed an error of law, and that is in the actual, not the weighing of the factors relative to each other, in the decision of whether a factor can conceivably apply amounts to double counting. We cite the Lipsick case out of the First Circuit as an illustration of why that's the legal question and not just a pure abuse of discretion.
So we are an appellate body, and you're suggesting that no remand is necessary. So wouldn't that place us in the role of a fact finder to determine the appropriate fee here? Can you flesh that argument out a bit?
Certainly, Your Honor. We agree, and we don't dispute that in the mine run of cases, remand would be the way to go here. It just so happens that in this case, we've agreed on a lodestar, so there's no question about that. We've agreed on several Kelly factors that are inapplicable. The rest, we say, as a matter of law, can't legally justify a departure in this instance. And so if you remand it, it's our position, there would essentially be nothing left for the trial court to do other than enter the lodestar figure. And there is authority out there that says in that narrow circumstance where the only issues are legal, the court can exercise its discretion at this point, save everybody time, avoid continuing separate litigation over attorney's fees, and modify the existing award. The Lipsett case from the First Circuit says that. The Nebraska Supreme Court has also adopted that standard, relying on Lipsett. I think there's ample authority for that proposition.
I want to take you back to the Chief Justice's question, and Justice Kern touched on it too, and that's our standard of review. And your response, if I understood it correctly, was something along the lines of, yeah, well, you know, a court necessarily abuses its discretion when it makes an error of law. And in an earlier response, you had said something along the lines of, hey, this is just this case, and, you know, we think that the Kelly factors are all contemplated, or, you know, there is a preemptive effect of the lodestar calculation here such that you really don't get to these. That seems like more than just this case. That seems like if we accept that argument, we're changing more than just the result. We're just affecting more than just the result in this case. That seems like it would resonate more, have a more durable effect. And the rule that could result would be, yeah, I mean, this lodestar factor takes a lot or many or most of the Kelly factors out of play. And that's different than what our cases say right now.
Respectfully, I'll push back slightly in that
all
I think the Kelly factors and the lodestar in your jurisprudence do currently coexist. They coexist just fine in federal jurisprudence, where it's been long established that the lodestar does a lot of this work. And that's okay. We're certainly not arguing for this is a one case only rule. I think our position is if the court below or the parties agree on a lodestar effect, and there's sufficient evidence in the records that makes clear that lodestar contemplates every possible justification for a deviation that could be warranted under the remaining Kelly factors, that there's nothing left to resolve. There are certainly a multitude of disputes I can imagine where that would not be the case, where, for example, a lodestar amount, or what is argued as a lodestar amount, might not actually capture an adequate market rate, and then the trial court, in its discretion, can make an adjustment at that stage. I think that would be pure abuse of discretion review. But in a case like this, where everybody agrees on the lodestar, everybody agrees on the inputs, and everybody agrees on the justifications for why those inputs were there, which happened to encompass the Kelly factors themselves, I think there's nothing left to resolve at the trial court stage.
So there was a lot of discussion about the Johnson case when you and opposing counsel argued this, which is a similar condemnation case and a determination of fees that was disputed. And in that case, we stated in that opinion that clearly the purpose of the statute that relates to fees in these types of cases is not to compensate landowners' counsel, but to reasonably reimburse the landowner for legal fees. And then there was a consideration of what did the landowner actually have to pay. So how does that weigh into your, and I, you know, understand all your arguments about the double counting, the lodestar, but it still seems like there is this additional consideration maybe in these particular types of cases that we refer to. Do you have any comment on that?
May I answer?
Your light's red, but you can answer the
Thank
questions.
Thank you. I think we should take care not to overread Johnson for what it, beyond what it says. I think there's just a pure factual difference that can justify a different result in Johnson, which is the amount of hours expended in that case wildly exceed the hours that were expended here. It was more than three times the amount. As far as legal justifications go, though, I would note that I've gone back, I've read the briefing in Johnson. The analysis in Johnson that we're all discussing here is not more than really three paragraphs, one of which is just reciting in a block quote the circuit court's rationale and analysis of the Kelly factors. The Johnson court was not presented with the legal arguments that we're making here about double counting, et cetera. It really had no occasion to consider that question. And so I don't think Johnson should be read as taking a position one way or another on that. The final point I'll address is I just think it would invite all manner of mischief if what Johnson actually stands for is that as long as the proposed fee award is in between the amount the city requests and the amount that the landowner would be entitled under a private contingency fee arrangement, it would effectively swallow the reasonableness question that we all agree is the foundation of the inquiry here. We would not have gotten this far if the proposed fee award was exceeded by what the city offered, and so that will never be the case. The case would have settled. And as illustrated by the very facts of this case, a landowner can build in the fee figure into the contingency arrangement such that basically ensuring that the amount that would be received under the contingency fee arrangement always exceeds the proposed fee award. And if Johnson stands for that, there essentially is no reasonableness review left.
Thank you, Mr. Dreesen.
Thank you.
Mr. Sargent, you may proceed with your argument.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, counsel. Most lay people think an appeal to this court is a do-over. They think that, okay, I had an issue decided by one judge, but now I get to go see five justices and get a fresh second opinion on all of the facts and the law of the case. Now, as lawyers, we all know that coming to this court isn't a do-over. This is a perfect case for this venue on this day, with all of these law students here and members of the general public. It's a perfect case to illustrate that an appeal to the Supreme Court isn't necessarily a do-over, It's an opportunity to for this court to apply the relevant appellate standard of review and then decide the case. So I'm guessing after hearing four arguments yesterday and getting through the first few months of their classes, the law students probably know what standard of review is. But what it is, it's the deference, the level of deference that this court shows to the lower court. And in this case, it's clear, the court's mentioned it, that the standard of review is abuse of discretion. Well, this court has given us some guidance. What does abuse of discretion mean? This court has said that we determine that an abuse of discretion occurred only if no judicial mind, in view of the law and circumstances of the particular case, could reasonably have reached such an conclusion. An abuse of discretion is a fundamental error of judgment, a choice outside the range of permissible choices, a decision which, on full consideration, is arbitrary and unreasonable.
We have actually backed away from that use of the judicial mind standard in State versus Delahoy. And just take a look at it. We don't need to go beyond that, but
sure.
Just look at Delahoy.
We've also said that an abuse of discretion is a misapplication of law. Your opposing counsel contends that there was a misapplication of law because the court didn't make specific findings related to the lodestar.
Well, I disagree with that. If you look at the court's findings of fact at finding of fact 15 and 16, it finds the hours that were spent, and it finds what the city's proposed fee was, and the transcript makes clear that that wasn't in dispute. I mean, the first thing that the judge did, Judge Clapper did, is he came in and said, okay, Mr. Sergeant, I think we need to start with an hourly fee and a rate. Do you agree with that? And I said, yes. And he said, the city is proposing $61,700. Do you agree that that's the starting point, that that's the number of hours by the hourly rate? And I agreed. And then what the judge did was, and you can picture it when you're reading the transcript, he pulled out Johnson, the 2003 case on this, and went through each one of the Kelly factors and talked about each one of them and let both sides argue about each one of those factors, why they should support my position, why they should support the city's position. And all of the arguments that the court's now heard today and heard in the brief, those were all made and they were considered, but they were rejected.
The second group of error of law that he alleges, as I understand it, is that the court erroneously essentially applied double factoring by using the factors from our case law in addition to the reasonable rate that you had already set and that they had agreed to. Why is that not an error of law that would lead to an abuse of discretion?
Well, I don't believe it's an accurate description of what the trial court did. My position is just using an hourly rate, as was proposed by the city in this case, leaves out several of the factors, all right? When saying that the hourly rate that I charge in eminent domain cases, and if you look at the affidavit that was filed, it says, in 26 years, I have rarely ever taken a case, an eminent domain case, on an hourly basis. But I have a couple times, and that's what I charged. To go back, one of the justices asked, was there any other record as to whether that was extremely high or low based on the market in the area? There wasn't. There wasn't any comparison to see whether that was a high premium of a fee or not.
And there was and let me just jump in there. I think you submitted, in addition to your affidavit, four affidavits from regional counsel, one in South Dakota, Minnesota, North Dakota, and they talked about what hourly rates are, what type of fee arrangements are reasonable or at least common within the industry as it relates to eminent domain cases. I don't think the state rebutted that. Not that they had to, but it seems like that information's out there in terms of, you know, that a contingent fee is from 25% to 40% is a very common fee in eminent domain cases, and your rate is in that reasonable range, and it doesn't seem like there's any evidence to the contrary of that in this record that was presented to the court.
There was not. The range from all the surrounding states in our region is from 33% to 50% of the lift, the amount that you get over the condemner's offer. And that's consistent across all of those states.
I'm going to stop you on that real quick. I just want to get my terms right here. So that's the lift, the lift that you're describing is the last offer from the condemner?
No.
Right, it's the first one, right?
It's the first one when you're
hired. And
that's
what your fee agreement, your law firm's fee agreement says.
Correct.
Right, I got you.
Right, so that's customary, right? The lift is calculated when you come to see me.
Yeah, yeah.
Or when in another state, you see the lawyer.
You carve the $51,000, that's off the table, it's all going forward, right?
Correct.
Can you explain the the result that you obtained for your client?
Yes, so in this case, the initial offer that the city made was $51,647, and that's the position that they took at trial. They did, 2 weeks before trial, offer $250,000, but the jury returned a verdict of $382,600. And with prejudgment interest, which is part of that, the total would be $427,000. So between what the city's last offer was 2 weeks before trial and the result obtained, that's a 70% increase. And it was 12 times what they offered when I was first hired. So what I would say about, in looking at all of these factors, by just using an hourly fee, again, that doesn't represent the results obtained at all. That's based on reputation, right? That's based on past conduct, not what was accomplished in this case. So if you just award that hourly fee and don't consider the results obtained, if you don't consider the fact that my actual fee agreement was a contingent fee agreement, then you're not considering all of the Kelly factors. And this court has said that in both Kelly and then again in Johnson, that this idea that only an hourly fee, only a fee based on an hourly calculation is reasonable, the court's rejected that twice. And there's not a lot of cases on this. If you look at where this court has really determined what's a reasonable fee, it's really only Kelly and Johnson. And so I'll jump in where Justice Salter had commented that if the court today says that an hourly fee, that it's only an hourly fee is reasonable, well, that's a complete change of the law. Right? It's the complete change of the law that Judge Clapper had in front of him. He had the most recent case from this court in front of him as he's going through the factors, and he applied them all. So certainly that can't be an abuse of discretion. If the position is that only an hourly fee is permissible, then really this court is not following the doctrine of stare decisis, another basic tenet that the law students should all know here.
I mean, the lodestar calculation is going to, not necessarily, but in many instances, it will account for the lodestar factors that relate to the customary fee and the time spent. Right. So why would we?
I disagree with that, Justice, because the customary fee charged is a contingent fee. So the lodestar doesn't contemplate that. There's no evidence in the record that it's in any way customary.
There's a separate category for, not to get too formulaic, but there is a separate Kelly consideration on whether it's fixed or contingent. And my only point was to sort of say, we've never held that this lodestar has any preemptive effect on looking at any of these factors. Some of them might be applicable, some might not be. So, for instance, on the result obtained, you know, the very nature of the fee-shifting mechanism in this statute compels a consideration of the result obtained, because you only get fee-shifting when you beat the offer by 20%,
And I would go back. I know Justice Devaney referenced that one of the purposes of this statute is to try and make the landowner whole, because the landowner didn't want this to happen, right? The landowner has been sued. But this court has also said, both in Kelly and Clark, that the purpose of this statute is, the quote is, the formula indicates that the legislature meant to discourage the condemner from making inequitably low jurisdictional offers.
It's an expression of public policy.
Right. That what we, in essence, we want to discourage litigation. That's what's that saying is, if you make good offers to these people within 20% of what they might get at judgment, that discourages litigation. That's good for the landowner. We don't want to have to sue our citizens to get their land. What the city has done here is loaded up their brief, both to the trial court and this court, with all of these federal cases, these civil rights cases under the 1988, 42 U.S.C. 1988. And that is a very different purpose by that statute. I looked, there's an ALR 43, ALR Fed 243, and those cases that ALR talks about, all of the cases that have talked about the purpose of the federal fee shifting statute, and it's different because that is intended to encourage the private enforcement of civil rights through litigation. It's encouraging people to come to court, to file lawsuits and to come to court. And the fee shifting statute is to entice competent counsel to provide legal services to people who could not normally afford to pay for a lawyer themselves. So these are very different concepts, right? The other part of 1988 statute is it's not mandatory. The trial court has discretion whether to award attorney's fees in a 1988 case. Now, we know they most often do, but this statute that we're dealing with here in South Dakota, it's mandatory, right? The statute says the court shall award a reasonable attorney fee if that 20% threshold is met. And that's what we've done. So I'm asking the court to affirm the trial court. There's been no abuse of discretion here. Judge Clapper went through the factors that were laid out in Kelly and reaffirmed in Johnson. There has been no change in the law. And in fact, you really couldn't find a more analogous case for Judge Clapper to use than the Johnson case. And they even have the same last name. But
confusing.
Yes.
It's Johnson.
So if the court has no other questions for me, thank you, and I'd ask the court to affirm Judge Clapper.
Thank you. Mr. Driesen, you may proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few points in response. I appreciate the ode to the abuse of discretion standard, but as has been established, an error of law is always a per se abuse of discretion. I would also note, too, that some of the federal cases on which we rely, Blum, the Supreme Court case in particular, was decided on abuse of discretion review and determined that the double counting constituted a reversible error.
I'm sorry, can you tell me again, and I know you've covered it, but for whatever reason I'm not placing, what's your error of law argument?
So there's two distinct errors of law. One is the failure outright to account for the lodestar in the written findings and conclusions of law.
So that's an error of law because there's no finding that says the lodestar is $61,000?
Essentially correct, yes.
And that would, and I went through that with you, do you think that that's going to yield a lot of different result on remand?
So that you lead me to the second point, which is I think it's a misapplication of the legal standard here to implement a double counting regime like this. It's not a misapprehension of the facts.
Is there a rule though that you're aware of that says that these factors can only ever be accounted for in a lodestar calculation, and that they can never be considered outside of that calculation?
So,
unless there's a rule that says that, I'm not sure that's a legal error.
So I think it adheres in the reasonableness standard. It's a matter of basic logic that if something's accounted for once and it's accounted for again, I think that constitutes legal error. because it misapplies the basic reasonableness standard by accounting for something twice when it could have been accounted for once. But I would note, too, again, Blum's Supreme Court case decided on abuse of discretion review, and it resulted in reversible error. As far as the characterization of the district court's findings of fact and conclusion of law go, I would note it, yes, it does recite the number of hours expended. It does recite what our request was for fees. It also recites what their request was for fees, and then promptly moves on to defend their request for fees as kind of a presumptively correct matter, applying the Kelly factor sort of as a retroactive defense of that principle rather than and warranting an increase from the lodestar figure. I think the question to ask yourself is, if you look at the findings of fact and conclusions of law, what would change if the circuit court had never heard of the lodestar figure? Would anything in those facts, written facts or conclusions, have changed? I think the answer is no. The analysis would have proceeded just the same if the lodestar didn't exist. And that is an error of law for failure.
That to me is a non-prejudice. That's you're making a no prejudice argument.
Well, the error, we're asserting error, and it proceeded the same way. So it's erroneous. It's erroneous in the sense that the failure to adhere to the lodestar resulted in an error, and that error prejudiced us as a consequence of resulting in the higher fee. I think the purposive argument that's been presented to here is just misplaced. We agree with this court's articulation of the standard, the reason why this statute was enacted in the first place, but it's still, the legislature, when it enacted it, still included a reasonableness standard, and in so doing incorporated a well-established body of law concerning what is and is not reasonable. That is the inquiry to decide. It's not whether just because the purpose behind the statute is to ensure the fair offer of fees, I don't think it follows that the landowner automatically gets the maximum possible fee within that framework. Finally, just a quick note on our reliance on federal cases. I think that the federal case law is firmly entrenched already in this court's jurisprudence in this area. When Kelly first announced the principle that the lodestar is the starting point, it's citing a Second Circuit decision. When this court announced that the lodestar generally reflects the full and adequate fee, citing Blum, a Supreme Court decision. The things we call the Kelly factors were first introduced into the jurisprudence in a Fifth Circuit case. This body of law comes from federal law, and they have a ton of experience applying it, in part because of Section 1988. It comes up all the time. It just doesn't come up as much in South Dakota jurisprudence. And I think it's perfectly fair to rely on those principles when they've already been embedded within this jurisprudence. What opposing counsel is asking for here is that that certain factors that are already embedded within the lodestar be accounted for twice, and that be permitted to result in an effective hourly rate that exceeds $1,000 per hour. The city would just respectfully submit that is not reasonable as a matter of law within the framework that this court has articulated. If there are no further questions, I would ask this court to vacate the award and install it as a replacement for the $61,740 figure, the lodestar. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning.